Darren, thank you for being so kind as to organize this conference, and in particular for being so really generous to have this day on my behalf, and I'm very grateful for that. Thank you very much, David. I am also extremely pleased that so many of the people that I have either worked with or that I admire a great deal for the work that they have done are here, and so I'm grateful for that as well. One says that, you know, one is humbled. I'm not at all humbled. I mean, I'm just having too much fun today to even have that sort of thing creep into my psyche. I should also say thank you to my wife, who ordinarily does not like to come to occasions like this. She's not a physicist, and you can well, you know, appreciate that, but thanks for being here, Jean. And now let me go on and then talk about a subject which has almost nothing to do with magnetic semiconductors. I will mention magnetic semiconductors only once, but really what I'm going to be talking about today are these magnetometers, which were briefly mentioned by David just a moment ago. I'm going to talk about submicron magnetometers and the applications to the study of nanomagnetism and biosensing. We have been very generously supported, at least in the past, by a number of organizations. So let me go on then and quickly talk about the acknowledgments. This is a multidisciplinary effort, as it turns out. The latter part of the talk will speak to how we use these magnetometers in an attempt to develop biosensors, and for that we need to be able to address things with biomolecules, which I know unfortunately nothing about, but I'm learning. And so Brian Chase and Jeff Strauss from FSU have been enormously important to, and continue to be very important. Peng Zhang is my closest collaborators, and these are postdocs and students, and I will mention them again. Of course, we couldn't do any of this work without the materials that we've been using in order to fabricate the magnetometers that we use, and that has come primarily recently from Tohoku University and also from Rockwell Scientific, who have generously supported us with indium arsenide quantum well materials, and I'll talk about that as well. So, some of you may know that we've been working on sensitivity of submicron Hall devices for some time, and I will just show this as sort of a summary slide. I'm not going to talk very much about these systems and how we got to where we are at all, just to recognize that if you look here, and let me just, I hope this thing comes up, yeah. You can actually depress the 1 over F noise to such an extent that we are capable in gallium arsenide, aluminum gallium arsenide materials of sensing less than 10 to the fourth spins. And this is at temperatures which are above 100 degrees Kelvin for all possible magnetic fields. And the thing that I wanted to show here is that David was very much involved in the genesis of this particular project, and so it's a particular pleasure for me to talk about these results. Okay, so anyway, the idea is here, the important point is that these are highly sensitive, and we're going to use them, or we have used them, in fact, for measuring the switching dynamic properties of spins, of magnetic particles. So I'll be talking about interaction effects at small scales. I'll say a few words about noise in submicron Hall devices. We've made some efforts to try to understand that a little bit better than we had in the past. Perhaps not understand, but we have discovered that if you make the make them smaller, then you get somewhat different characteristics. And then finally, I'll talk about ongoing research, which certainly is not finished, in our attempt to produce biosensors using these devices. So these are Hall devices that I'm talking about. So let's talk about interaction effects. Jens Müller is the person who is primarily responsible for that work. At our laboratory, we have a method for being able to make long magnetic pillars. This is a magnetic pillar. And we can put them onto substrates which are conducting. And the way we do that is we use UHV STM system, into which we introduce a very noxious gas, iron carbonyl, which then dissociates in the presence of a small voltage of roughly 18 volts. And basically what happens is that dissociates, it leaves the iron behind, and then the rest of it is pumped off. And when we do that, then we can make these pillars, depending on how far we retract our tip. So this is called STM-assisted CVD. We can, well, I mean, I think it's maybe a strong word to say we can exactly position the pillars where we want them. We would be able to do that if we had a more modern STM. We're still working with one which is quite old, and it tends to relax its piezo, so we don't always come back to the same place. But we can make pillars with diameters from 5 to 20 nanometers, with heights which vary mostly between 80 and 250 nanometers. And as you can see from this atomic force micrograph, when we're lucky, we can make very nice arrays with lattice constants which are larger than roughly 80 nanometers ordinarily. And once again, I want to mention, you know, that a lot of this early work has its genesis in work that David did and that we actually collaborated on very early on. So what are these micro-hall magnetometers? Basically, these are gradiometers in which we actually have a Hall device that looks like this, and then we have current going in this end and this end. They're synchronized in such a way that if there is nothing on these crosses, any stray field will go out, so we don't have any signal. On the other hand, if you put something on one of the crosses, you will see the signal from that. And in the case of these magnetic particles, basically what we will see when we put them on this gate, which is ordinarily from gold, the dipolar field which emanates from them is then sensed by this 2D electron system underneath. So these are heterostructures. And as I mentioned before, they're very sensitive. So here, for example, is one which is roughly of a channel width of 500 nanometers. And what you see are two pillars. This one is right in the middle. This one is right at the edge. So its signal is very, very small, it turns out. It's not going to contribute very much. And when you do that, then you can really look at one tiny nano a magnet, and you can see a very nice hysteresis loop, and we've studied these as a function of a variety of things, and I just wanted to show you that we have this type of sensitivity for these devices. Now, let me just go back for a second. Supposing we now took this gate, which is ordinarily gold, and we put something else underneath it, for example, or some other ferromagnetic substrate, then it might be possible to magnetically study the interaction effects between pillars and the substrate. And that is of some interest because we would like to know, first of all, what these interaction effects are. Are they dipolar interactions? May they also be exchange interactions? And we thought that we would be able to look at some of that. Certainly, they do exist, as you see from this picture. This is some earlier work where we had permalloy and we had an array of these magnetic particles on them. And as you can see, well, you can't see the particle-particle interactions, but it turns out that many of these things switch as pairs at exactly the same time when you do magnetic force microscopy. This is a magnetic force micrograph, and as you can see in the intermediate state, you have this very strange sort of stripe state in which, if you look at it, the whites may have their magnetization pointed out of the board, and the ones next to it will have their magnetization pointed into the board. That's not what you might expect ordinarily, and it's due to the fact that there's an interaction between permalloy and the array above it. But this is a rather complicated system. What we had hoped to be able to do is actually to develop a system, now that we have higher sensitivities, in which we take just one particle and put it on something whose magnetization we know very well. And so that led us to look at an, as a quote, simple test system, as I will unfortunately be able to demonstrate to you. It's not in the least simple, but at least we can take a look at it, and we have to do a lot more work. All of these things are not published as yet, and we're still working on them. So these are relatively new results. So here is one of these samples. This is a sample where we have put one of these pillars right at the center of a small hall cross of line width, once again, roughly 500 nanometers. I should also point out that in gallium arsenide, gallium aluminum arsenide, you have depletion regions, and therefore the active area is actually quite a bit smaller. And so now this europium sulfide, and this is the only time I will mention magnetic semiconductors, is my favorite magnetic semiconductor. It's europium sulfide. It's a concentrated magnetic semiconductor. It is an S-state ion, therefore it doesn't have very much anisotropy at all. And so you're completely dominated by shape effects in this system. And it has a TC, which is quite low, but it allows you to look above and below the ordering temperature. So you can make some comparisons if you wish. Because these had to be conducting for us to put the pillars down, we can actually make these thin films a little bit conducting. They're conducted about 25 degrees Kelvin or somewhere in between there. And it turns out that even though we didn't know whether we could grow magnetic particles on the europium sulfide, we can. This is another sample. This is a sample which we didn't want to use because they were not placed directly on top of the cross, but it demonstrates that we do have magnetic particles on there. This is at room temperature where the europium sulfide is paramagnetic, and therefore we can now look at the magnetic force microscope. If you look at these two dots here, which may not be so visible in the back, if we switch the magnetization into the board, this switches as well. So these are definitely magnetic states. So now let's take a look at what the magnetization of this thing looks like. And here are the raw data. So this is from a single iron particle on europium sulfide. This is the output of the Hall voltage as a function of magnetic field, which is swept. There are essentially two types of events, ones which occur at about 0.2 Tesla, and then some that occur at a somewhat smaller field strength of about 0.07 Tesla, 0.08 Tesla. And they're separate events. This one here deals with the iron particles themselves switching in the presence of the magnetic field. And that's well known. We've done a lot of work on these, and so we know where they're supposed to switch. And this is completely new and has to do with the interactions of the magnetic particle with the europium sulfide. And as you'll notice, if you look at the temperature dependence, these outer ones don't change very much, but the inner one that grows. So let's take a look what else we can say about that. It's clear that this inner one will have something to do with europium sulfide already. So what I'd like to do is I'd like to just take a cut. We'll just take a look at the outer ones. And here are the results. If we now subtract these two curves to actually display the hysteretic effects of the iron nanoparticles, this is what we obtain. It's rather noisy, it turns out. But nonetheless, if we look at it, we see that there's roughly a switching field of about 0.2 Tesla. It is not straight, so that means there are already interaction effects and there are fields there which are not completely out of the board. And furthermore, the switching field does not change as a function of temperature. You wouldn't expect that because it's iron. Iron has a very large transition temperature. So there we are. So, and it turns out that we can also manage from the signal that we observe here, we can translate that into an average field that is seen by the 2D electron system. And if we know how far it is, we can calculate what that means in terms of moment, and therefore we can calculate the dimension of the particle. The dimension of the particle is about 40 nanometers in the case, which is somewhat larger than we ordinarily have. Now let's take a look at the inner one. So that's the one that I want to look at. And its switching is entirely different. First of all, it's much larger. The signal is much larger, even at 12 degrees Kelvin. And it's very sharp, but it's very complex. It goes down, then it comes up again, goes down again, and then it's very sharp, the hysteresis. We can also say something about the temperature dependence of where these switching events occur. I don't think that's what I wanted. Let me see. Yes, the switching, the EUS switching field, if you will, although we haven't identified it as yet, actually decreases and it becomes sort of small. It's in within the resolution of what we can actually measure, but there's clearly a decrease which occurs as we come closer to 17 to 20 degrees Kelvin, and that's indicative also that we're going towards the transition temperature of europium sulfide. We can also look at the temperature dependence of the magnitude of this effect, and if we look at that, then this is what we observe. So the magnitude of this magnetization, if you will, quote, which is the size of the Hall voltage that we observe, actually has a susceptibility-like feature, and that is understood. We know how to understand that. We can actually compare that to a similar field, measurement of the susceptibility of the europium sulfide, and it fits right on top of there. So we know that this effect is definitely driven by the europium sulfide in this case. So we have interaction effects. They're competing interaction, it turns out. If we're at the peak here, that's where the susceptibility of the europium underlying europium is highest, and that means therefore that the effective field that's seen will be included in whatever polarization can occur due to this magnetic pillar that's sitting on there. We can also manage to calculate, just in the way we did the diameter of the pillar itself, the diameter over what region this thing is being polarized. The thickness of this film is about 70 nanometers, and so this is 100 nanometer diameter. So it's rather a large volume that's being polarized right near the highest susceptibility point, which of course is near TC. And then as you go to lower temperatures, clearly the exchange interactions of the europium sulfide itself takes over, and we can no longer bend these spins towards that place. So we basically have a very complicated story. I won't go into the details. It's a very complicated structure, much more complicated than we expected, and we're still working on trying to understand that. But it's clear that we see very pronounced interaction effects, and so we will try to do more to understand that. This summarizes what we wanted to say about that there exist complex competing magnetic interactions between the europiums, iron and europium, and maybe interaction effects of the irons through the europium. If once we understand that, we can then look at interactions between particles on these. For example, a particle here and a particle here, possibly even things like Peter Schiffer is doing, you know, with his small permalloy materials to look at frustration effects. And in fact, we should also look at the transport underneath. I don't remember when I started. Pardon me? I have 1 minute left? Yeah, that's nice. Half, 15 minutes? Okay. All right. So I'll say just a few words of some work that we've been doing on transport in these. So what we decided to do is to look at a permalloy film, which we're isolating from the magnetic particles. This is an array of magnetic particles, and then look at the transport effects as a function of magnetic field. You see a rather modest but negative magnetoresistance. The explanation for that actually is in terms of an anisotropic magnetoresistance effect, which is known in permalloy. But in principle, it should be able to engineer, you know, some of these characteristics if we knew where to place these pillars, okay? So let me just say a couple of other things. This effect is relatively robust. It even exists at room temperature, so we would think that we can perhaps even look at things at room temperature. I'm not going to say anything more about this. I just mentioned it a moment ago. But we can't forget about resistance changes due to domain wall formation, at least in permalloy, so perhaps what we should do is look at something else. We do want to make small constrictions, and we're presently doing that, in which we put either one or two of these small magnetic pillars to see whether or not we can actually increase the effect that was observed. And it certainly will be a room temperature effect, but I don't know how large it's going to be. So the future work may also include, or we hope, and we are trying right now, to include gallium manganese arsenide, which we've kindly received from David Auschlom's group, it's known that it has a very large planar Hall effect, and so some of these effects may become quite enhanced when we do that. So that's all I really wanted to say about these interaction effects. And I want now to go on to noise in the submicron Hall devices. Again, this is work that's done by Jens Müller, and these materials that we're looking at are from Tohoku University. So, as I've already shown you, the Hall device looks like this. We put on it these magnetic particles, but we would like to be able to do something to increase the moment sensitivity. And if you take a look at one of these particles and then calculate what the effective magnetic field is that emanates this dipole field, which can be done very easily for simple configurations at least, then it looks sort of like this. And let's say that this is now our Hall cross. I think it's clear that if I make my Hall cross smaller, then the average field that that thing is going to see is going to be larger, and that will increase the sensitivity of a Hall device. So miniaturization is absolutely critical in order to boost the sensitivity. We've been working with 1 micron systems. We obviously want to work with smaller systems. And so in order to understand that, we need to understand the development of 1/f noise, because if it were just a matter of decreasing the size, then we would just basically follow this line and the effective field that we see would increase for any given particle that we have on top of it. But it turns out that's not the case. It sort of has a peak and then it decreases. This is due to mesoscopic effects. It's also, and most importantly, due to the fact that the noise of any device will increase as you shrink it. So I will just very quickly go over some recent noise measurements, I hope. Yes, there we go. So now this is the noise power spectrum of a Hall sensor, which is about 0.75 microns in channel width. And what you see here, this is now aluminum gallium arsenide at 45 degrees Kelvin. And as I already mentioned, maybe I didn't mention it before, but one of the reasons that we get such high sensitivity in these materials is quite contrary to what you might expect. The gold layer that was on top of the device, which acted as a gate, we could put on a modest gate voltage of 200 millivolts and reduce the noise, in this case, by two orders of magnitude. That's really remarkable. You'd think that the noise would increase because the gate is usually something that gives you gain in any system. But this is in fact the case. And so what we have here is really a powerful way of making more sensitive Hall sensors. But if we now shrink the size of our line width, then all hell breaks loose. What you find, even when you have a gate voltage of 200 millivolts, then the 45 degree curve, you know, which was this blue curve earlier, now this is the same one as this one, it no longer has 1/f like character. In fact, it's quite different. It looks more Lorentzian, which is something that suggests that we have a single fluctuator. And so we can study this Lorentzian, and that's been done. So what one sees is if you plot the frequency times the noise power spectrum, then what you see is this hump, which essentially shows you where the peak frequency is for any given temperature. One can plot that. So we can plot these locus of these points on a log plot against 1/T. And that's suggested by this Arrhenius type arrangement, where we can see that basically we have a single fluctuator fluctuating to and fro, and we don't know exactly what it's due to right now, except that we now have good evidence that it's due to DX centers, because these things are about 30% aluminum in them, you know, the algas gas. And so we would expect DX centers. In fact, we know that we can't operate these devices for very high temperatures. They're limited to approximately 100, 125 degrees Kelvin. And so this is actually, as far as I know, the first definitive experiment of a single fluctuator model where you can define, without doing more data analysis, a single sort of Lorentzian. If you plot that, it's a very nice plot. We have an attempt frequency, which is roughly the attempt frequency that you would expect, with an activation energy, which is of order 0.88 millielectron volts. And we believe, as I mentioned a moment ago, that this is due to trapping and detrapping of electrons from d excenters, and we have some evidence for that. It also limits these devices, right? We can't use them at higher temperatures. And so what we have to do is we have to look for other evidence, other materials. And that brings us to indium arsenide, aluminum antimonide, quantum well heterostructures. And these are absolutely remarkable materials because if you look, for example, at the noise spectral density of indium arsenide, this is a 1 by 1 micron Hall cross, and it's nicely 1 over F. It behaves the way it should. That means that if we increase the current by a factor of 2, or if we increase the magnetic field by a factor of 2, the noise increases proportionally. Well, it goes actually like I squared and B squared, and they fall on top of one another. But if we now look at the other side, we just transpose this red curve over to this panel over here, and if we compare it to a gallium arsenide, aluminum gallium arsenide material of roughly the same size, it's a little bit smaller, nonetheless, we can see that the noise without gating is much, much higher at the same temperature, which in this case was 75 degrees as it is over here. And even when we gate it, which was the way that we were able to get around, you know, get having as much noise, it's still only comparable to indium arsenide quantum wells. So we have high hopes that we can use this at room temperature, and it turns out they're really wonderful materials for that. And that brings me now to the basically what I really wanted to talk about, which was the biosensors. The work here is done primarily by a graduate student. His name is Goran Mihaljevic. He's a wonderful graduate student. And we've had some help, especially in the self-assembly, by Pradeep Manandar, Hideo Ono, and Tohoku University and Rockwell Scientific, as I already mentioned, provided these indium arsenide quantum well materials for our purposes. So what do we want if we want to use a Hall sensor for biological sensing? Well, ultimately, what you'd like to do is you'd like to functionalize a target molecule somehow with some sort of magnetic particle. You'd like to be able to put onto the Hall cross a complementary molecule. And then if you put it into solution with this goop, you'd like to be able to capture the magnetic particles on top of the cross. Now, furthermore, these magnetic labels, they have to be superparamagnetic, because if they are ferromagnetic, they will agglomerate and you will not be able to keep them in solution. And that's why commercial magnetic beads are all iron oxide, and they're in a limit where they're superparamagnetic. And that's what we're using as well. Now, the sizes of these things should be comparable to the size of the target molecule that we're trying to observe. And that means we have to go, you know, all the way from perhaps 450 nanometer size particles or more to things which are of order to 10 to 100 nanometers. And that's where the challenge of all of this is. You'd like to be able to get sensitivities which will allow you to measure a single one of these beads. And that's not an easy task. So I just remind you something that I already said earlier, that the Hall voltage is inversely proportional to the area of the Hall cross, and that means that we want to make our Hall crosses as small as possible. Now, how do we detect a superparamagnetic particle? A superparamagnetic particle has a magnetization versus field a curve, which is a Langevin function. It has no hysteresis, and so we don't really know whether or not we have something on there unless we can test it by looking at the slope of this curve at zero field, then providing a DC field, and looking at the slope at a somewhat higher field. That's the way we'll know whether or not we have a particle on there. And so that's what we do. We have an AC magnetic field as well as a DC magnetic field. If there were no particle, and in particular if the sensor output is completely linear, which we need in order to see these small changes in the magnetization, then what we would expect is there's no particle, then basically the voltage will be independent of any DC field that we put on it. On the other hand, if there's a particle there, we would expect to have a drop in the AC Hall voltage that we're observing by lock-in techniques. And furthermore, I should make the point that this change in voltage, this AC voltage, which can be translated in change in the moment, is dependent on both fields, the AC as well as the DC field, so we have some parameter space to try to boost up our sensitivity. The other thing that I must mention is the linear response is absolutely essential for these things, so we have to try very hard to try to characterize them. So this is this very complex stack. The active area is the one in red here. This is a Hall cross that's made from this. It's about 1 micron. And what you can see is that the voltage, the Hall voltage as a function of magnetic field, is completely linear for, well, in this case, 0.2 Tesla, but it actually is linear for fields much higher than that. And furthermore, this is done for a variety of different currents. If we now divide this voltage by the current, then we get the Hall resistivity. And as you can see, everything collapses essentially on the same line except for the smallest current. Never mind, the point is that the slope is exactly the same for all of them. In this case, I think it was 620 ohms per Tesla. So these are very good materials. They're completely linear, which is one of the most important characteristics that we need. And furthermore, we can also estimate now from the noise what our field resolution might be. So basically, the minimum field is going to be given by the Hall voltage noise that you have divided by the maximum current that you have there. Right? So we can actually define an N sub B, which is sort of the noise equivalent spectral density of the magnetic field, if you will. And we can plot that by measuring the noise, the Hall voltage noise. And what you see here is just that, this constant here, which is basically proportional to the Hall voltage noise. It increases with increasing current, as we would expect. So on the other hand, we also, the sensitivity of our device will increase. So that would be very nice because the whole signal, on the other hand, if we look at the limiting noise or field resolution, if you will, of our device, it turns out by the time that we put in about 10 microamps, everything collapses onto one curve, and we will not be able to reduce the noise any further to increase our resolution, to decrease this number any further. And the reason for that is that we have Joule heating and various other things which limit things. And so we're limited basically to 10 microamps at most. Maybe if we're operating at higher frequencies, we'd do better. But as you can see, if we were operating at 100 hertz with a one second time constant, our resolution, you know, is about, you know, 0.1 Gauss, and it's fractions of a maybe 20 milligauss or so if we go to higher frequencies. So that's actually pretty good. So having said all of that, can we actually make measurements using this? And the answer is yes. Actually, this is a spectacular, in my opinion, result. We're very happy to see that. This is one of these Hall crosses. It's a 1 micron line width. In this case, the magnetic bead was placed there with micro tweezers. It's a super paramagnetic bead, which has a dimension of approximately 1.2 microns. It's iron oxide. It's super paramagnetic. And the question is, can we actually, you know, look at it? And as you can see, we have a just wonderful result. You see, the signal-to-noise ratio here, and the reason this is as a function of time, just so that we could see what our effective noise was. The signal-to-noise ratio is estimated to be approximately a factor of 50 in this case. So even for a 1 micron bead, we can see a very, very large signal. So we're very happy with that, but we'd like to be able to do a bit better. Before I go to that, though, I mean, we certainly don't want to use micromanipulators to put our beads on there. That doesn't serve the purpose of trying to use it as a magnetic detector. And so I want to say just a word or two, not about this, but there are various ways of self-assembling nanoparticles on magnetic beads. But what I would like to do is to look at the second one of these, because that's what we did next. It is possible, and of course this is not something that I know very much about, I'm just really starting to learn. It turns out that if you thiolate, which means you put a sulfur end group onto DNA, in this case it's a red strand of DNA, it will actually bond to gold very easily. And one can also use a strategy of decorating another DNA strand, this green one, say, with a magnetic bead. In our case, we're going to be talking about 250 nanometer magnetic beads. So these are already much smaller than ones that I showed a moment ago. And then we have a third complementary DNA, which will seek out both the green and the red, and will bond to them. And then that means that we've captured the magnetic bead on our gold template. So this is one scheme that can be used not only to put beads on there, but actually if you're looking for something like this molecule, you know, this DNA strand for some reason, this would be a way of actually detecting it. Well, you can do that if you're just trying to put the bead there. But this allows you, you know, this allows you, if you're interested in finding what this one is, right? There's no way for me to actually decorate the material that I would like to be able to detect easily beforehand. I have a solution of material which has many, many different kinds of, let's say, DNA strands in it. So what I would like to do is to pre-prepare in such a way that only this particular one will actually bond to them so that I can grab a hold of it. But what you say is correct. I mean, if I wanted just to put the magnetic beads on there, then it's easy, and then I do a two-step process. Yeah. So anyway, I just wanted to mention this. And here is, okay, what we've done. Again, this is this thing that I talked about a moment ago. What you see on the left-hand side, if you look carefully, this is the Hall device. This is still a 1 micron Hall device. We have 250 nanometer superparamagnetic beads. What you see there, that little square, is actually our gold gate. And if we focus in on that, that's the same square, then these yellow lines are actually where the hole cross is. And, you know, the signal is only sensitive to, the Hall cross is only sensitive to signals from beads which are actually on it. So this white cluster over here is magnetic beads, 250 nanometers in size. If you look carefully with a lover's eye, it's either 5 or 6 of those beads on there, okay? So if 5 or 6 of these beads right on the cross, and on the left, on the right-hand side, you see that we can actually measure that as well. Now, that's really very good, because I don't think anybody's done that as yet. We've been able to measure basically six of these beads. As you can see, the signal-to-noise ratio, even though it's quite high still, and we're working on improving that, is of order about 7 or 8, so it should be possible to look at one of these 250 nanometer beads. And I have, we're actually working on that now, and we hope to have that done. May I have 5 more minutes? Yeah. But can we look at even smaller particles? And this brings me to the final 5 minutes. Basically, I will go over this rather quickly. We have cobalt nanoparticles, which were made by our chemistry department. They have a very good distribution of approximately 7.3 nanometers. We can prove that independently by analyzing the Langevin function of these superparamagnetic beads. This is a whole bunch of them. And we can extract from that the magnetic moment of any one particle. If we use an AC field and a DC field of this magnitude, we can actually then sense roughly about a change in moment of 4,360 μb. And I've already mentioned to you that we can decrease our size, then we can increase the sensitivity. So for 1 by 1 micron Hall cross, we have a sensitivity of 0.2 milligauss. But if we have a bead sitting on here, and we now look at a 300 by 300 nanometer, then we will see an average field of 10 milligauss. So we clearly want to make submicron Hall sensors. And that's what we've done. And this is actually, Goran is very proud of that, as am I. These are line widths of about 250 nanometers. For various materials reasons, there is no depletion in the indium arsenide quantum well material, because if there were, then we would not be able to push any current through it at all. So we have this very nice cross. We can then take a look at the physical properties of that. But before I do that, I just wanted to show you something else that we're doing, which is to actually do on-chip micromagnetic rings in order to be able to oscillate the field right on chip. Here is one of these crosses. Here's a sample with two crosses. And this is the Hall sensor, which is 250 nanometer line width, channel width. It's absolutely remarkable. They're absolutely beautiful. They have this very wonderful, you know, linear response that we expected. And if you plot the same thing as this noise equivalent spectral density of the field, we have a resolution which is unfortunately not as good as it was before, because it's a smaller device and therefore the noise is higher. Nonetheless, if we translate that into the number of cobalt particles that we can see, we are still doing a lot better, because the field seen by any by the Hall device, which is smaller, is so much larger that we still win. And so this is the final slide I wanted to show. And we're working on trying to detect this at the moment, but in principle, we should be able to detect something, you know, off the order of 100 of these small particles at a frequency of 100 hertz, and even fewer at 1,000. If we have 100 nanoparticles, cobalt nanoparticles, that means roughly about 4 × 10⁵ μb. So this is a room temperature Hall sensor, which has a sensitivity of approximately, you know, 4 × 10⁵. So anyway, that is the end of the story. I think that we've come a long way in trying to develop Hall sensors for biomedical applications or for biosensing applications. We're continuing this work, and we have really high hopes that we'll do quite well with it. I also told you a little bit about gallium arsenide, aluminum gallium arsenide heterostructures, and they are, although I didn't talk about it very much, excellent probes for the study of nanomagnetism. I said a few words about interaction effects. So I'll leave you with this. We're very proud of 10⁵ μb at room temperature. And so thank you very much for your attention, and particularly thank you all for staying on this Friday evening. Well, that's what I. Well, that's not what we're interested in here. We're interested in actually, you know, ultimately, you know, being able to detect, say, in a soup of DNA or other molecules. We would like to detect specific ones first by preparing Hall sensors, which have recognizer molecules on them. There are various ways of doing that, and we have some of them. We'd use dip pen nanolithography. We can do printing. I haven't talked about those techniques. So here you have your molecule, you know, which can sense something. And the one way to do that actually is as Alan said, you know, somehow prepare the material that you want to sense and put beads on it, right? But that's difficult ordinarily. But if you were able to do that, then in a certain amount of time, using microfluidic channels, which we're trying to develop, you can then inject into the area of the Hall cross some sample of this, and in principle, you can then grab a hold of one which has a bead, and we can then detect that. This is not meant for delivery, for drug delivery. For drug delivery, I think that people, by and large, are going to look for ferromagnetic particles, by and large, because they want to be able to detect them. It's an entirely different story. I mean, does that answer your question a little bit? Yeah. Yes, they're actually not right at the they're not at the 2D electron system, so the fluctuations are really causing fluctuation in the potential. Yeah, so it's primarily a mobility effect. Although there's also the possibility actually that some of them actually then find their way into the 2D electron system. We don't know how to separate those out. Yes. Well, at the moment, we are actually envisioning it to try to detect certain specific DNA fractions which occur as a precursor to heart attacks, because that's what this guy is interested in, you know. The biological guy is a man who's interested in heart function. So that's one specific application, but in general, it is a way of trying to detect things that you don't want, like, I don't know, anthrax or something, I don't know. I mean, it's not that, you know. But genome I think that's more, that's a little bit more challenging now, at least for us. I mean, we want to first be able to just do one thing at a time. Yes. Well, the major advantage of using magnetic things is if you don't have optical access, which very often you don't have. I mean, for example, I mean, one envisions things in which you will try to have, you know, some sort of, I mean, you know, some little device, and you know, you go, you know, something happens to somebody, you go there, you take a little piece of their blood and find out what's going on. You don't do that with a laser and, you know, the other things. More portable and for commercial applications, there's good reason to believe that this is a good way to go. Yeah. I mean, one of the ways that we are actually attempting to assure that what the kind of self-assembly that we're doing here is correct is to use optical techniques, just to make sure that we're doing the right thing. Yes? No, I mean, the way this is actually done is that you, when you're going to do it in solution, which is what we do for other applications, which I haven't talked about, you actually protect everything with SiO2. And so you won't, in principle, won't get very large changes, you know. If you're thinking of the wires which are not on the Hall cross, is that what you're talking about? Yeah. Yeah. I haven't thought in detail about that. I do know that you know, it would have to be magnetic field dependent, and so I think that we can be relatively selective. It's more difficult to try to actually to have a false reading. That is, you know, you actually bind to something that you think is the one that you do, and you don't do that. So this is one of the reasons that we're trying to make our sensors also very small, so you only can place, you know, a very limited molecule on there, and then have possibly correlation, you know, measurements with two Hall crosses, you know, stuff like that.
Well, thank you once again. Thank you all.